And welcome to the Rick House. Folks, my name is Cyrus Farmer. You are watching and listening to the Stomp the Tea podcast, and we have a lot to get into tonight. So let me tell you exactly what you can expect to hear from our wonderful little program. We will be talking about the Open Championship and its results that just got finished playing out at Royal Port Rush. We'll also be talking about Bleacher Report. They released the latest NBA Top 100 of All Time list. I have some thoughts on some of their selections, and I'd love to hear some of your thoughts about my thoughts additionally. And of course, we'll also be covering the second episode of the Live Aid When Rock and Roll Took on the World documentary from CNN. Episode 2 just aired this past Sunday. I think it wraps up this coming Sunday with episode 3. We will get into that, as well as everyone's favorite segment, What Are You Drinking Tonight? But first, I need to do a little housekeeping. Folks, last week we debuted a new segment, an end of summer segment, that basically dealt with iconic sports theme music. Like an idiot, I didn't realize that playing music, copyrighted music on my phone would not pass muster on YouTube or Spotify or Apple Music or even TikTok. So what ends up happening is you end up hearing, instead of music, you hear silence because the music is removed because it's copyrighted. So, good for them. I have nothing against that. I'm all for copyright protections. But it did make last week's debut of that segment a little bit of a debacle, to say the least. But I want to try this again, folks, because I love this idea and I'm really into it. So this time I am going to try singing the iconic theme music and see if you recognize it. I'm pretty sure you will. Most of these tunes are very, by definition, memorable. That's part of what makes them iconic. What is today's dive into iconic sports theme music? Well, folks, it is a tune called Round Ball Rock. What is Round Ball Rock? You know it, and I know it, as the NBA on NBC theme music. Cue the music. Dun 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 dun. All right, so in case that gets blacked out, I'm only doing a brief portion of it, so there's not dead air for 16 minutes. Folks, I think you all recognize that music. When you hear that music, to me, that music says Michael Jordan. It says the Bulls. There's a reason for that. This music was created by a man named John Tesh. It was composed by John Tesh. John Tesh, for those of you who may or may not know, John Tesh was a kind of an entertainment host. He hosted a show called Entertainment Tonight. I believe it's still on the air. I think Mario Lopez hosts the show now. But from 1986 to 1996, John Tesh was one of the co-hosts of Entertainment Tonight. You know, just this daily magazine show about the doings in Hollywood and New York in the entertainment industry. But he had this side passion. He'd always loved music, and he always wanted to pursue a music career. So shortly after, I don't know when, but he left the show in 1996, Entertainment Tonight. But in 1990, apparently, NBC got the rights to NBA basketball, which I think they'd previously been held by, I think, CBS. I think CBS held them for years, and then NBC brought the rights. Long story short, Tesh is in Paris covering the Tour de France, and he gets this offer to write the theme music. Well, he wakes up in the middle of the night with this idea. He has a melody in his head, but he can't write it down. He doesn't have pen, he doesn't have paper, doesn't have sheet music, blank sheet music, where he can actually compose the notes. So he calls his own answering machine back in Los Angeles and sings, hums, you know, dictates the melody over the answering machine so that he would have it, and then goes back to sleep. It's kind of like Keith Richards with Satisfaction. It's weird. There's a story there if you've ever read the Keith Richards book, Alive. Great book, by the way. So long story short, Tesh gets back to Los Angeles, listens to this recording he sent to himself of himself singing this theme music, and the Round Ball Rock was born. Look, the funny thing about the whole story behind this, Tesh thought when he was composing the theme music, he said he wanted it to kind of mimic a fast break in basketball. So tempo was kind of a big thing for him. He didn't want anything mid-tempo. He wanted something upbeat. And oddly enough, he'd never been to a professional basketball game in person prior to composing this theme. And this theme is obviously used by NBA radio now. It will be debuted again this fall for by NBC as the theme music for the NBA on NBC. It's just an iconic piece of music. It really, really, when you hear this music, the first thing I think is basketball. So that is tonight's installment. Hopefully that did not get blacked out. But on to the show. Okay. The Open Championship. Folks, first and foremost, we would like to congratulate Scottie Scheffler on winning this year's Open Championship, his first Open Championship title, and his fourth major overall. Boy, oh boy, oh boy. Scottie Scheffler is a handful. Look, we all talked about this. We've been talking about this for a couple of years. When Scottie Scheffler shows up, hide the women and children. I mean, essentially, he's been very difficult to beat, especially in these big events, i.e. majors. So with Scottie's win, obviously, he goes into next year, the 2026 season, a U.S. Open win away from the career Grand Slam. Is it possible we could have two golfers completing the career Grand Slam in back-to-back years? I think it's very possible. I don't know if it's likely, but I think it's definitely very possible. Scottie Scheffler is playing some great, great golf. I mean, let's be fair. There have been a lot of comparisons with Scottie Scheffler to Tiger Woods. I don't believe most of those comparisons hold water yet. But they are certainly worth comparing. Look, one thing is without question. Scottie, right now, over the last, let's say, 2 years in particular, but 4 years really, he has been as dominant a golfer as we have ever seen since Tiger Woods. I mean, no other golfer outside of Tiger has dominated, you know, his peers this way. And it's been, you know, really interesting to watch. I mean, Scottie could always play golf. I mean, even before he, I mean, this was the rookie of the year. So he could always play golf. His big issue was putting early in his career. You know, he was kind of up and down with the putter. But apparently, and I don't know if this is true or not, but I did read this somewhere. Apparently, a couple of years ago, Rory was hanging out with Scottie, I think pre-tournament or post-tournament or doing a pro-am or whatever. And Rory was looking at Scottie's putting stroke and said essentially, hey, you should think about switching to a mallet putter instead of a blade, using the blade you're using right now. Allegedly, Scotty switched to a mallet putter, and the rest is history. I mean, no one's been able to stay within, you know, three shots of him in any particular tournament that he plays. It's been pretty amazing. I do have to say, I'm a little surprised, personally, that there has not been more competitive pushback against this run that Scottie Scheffler has been on. Let's be fair. Let's be absolutely honest. I thought that pushback would come from Rory McIlroy. I have been, to this point, completely wrong on that. I think Rory did what he could at Royal Portrush, but he was too far back to start, and it was going to be hard for him to make any real move against Scotty with such a large lead. I mean, it's just, when Scotty has that kind of lead, he's not going to come back to you. You have to go get him, and it's almost impossible to go get him because his lead is so large, and he is not going to stay at even par for the day. He's going to increase his lead, or at least go lower than even par. So you have to shoot even lower than that four-stroke lead that you're facing at the beginning of the day. So there's that. Look, we all know that Scotty has out-executed relentlessly his peers on tour these days, but I do have to say, I really thought, you know, if Rory didn't do it, I thought Xander Schauffele would challenge Scotty a little more consistently. I thought there was even a chance that Justin Thomas could challenge Scotty here and there. But no one has been up to the task. It's actually been very, very fascinating. Look, for Scotty, in my mind, to be compared to Tiger Woods and his accomplishments, I know they're on pace currently for the, they both won their fourth major, apparently, in the same number of days, Scotty and Tiger, which is great. But for me personally, I need to see Scotty do this for at least another 4 years and probably another six majors, major wins. For me personally, to compare him to Tiger, because golf is a very fickle game. It can come and go. Well, more on that later, but, you know, it's not that easy to sustain. Tiger had, you know, probably about 13, 14, 15 years of unparalleled greatness. And that doesn't happen by accident, and it's not that very easy to do. That's how you end up with 15 majors, 82 PGA Tour wins. So, Scotty is on a fantastic track. He's clearly the number one golfer in the world. He's definitely the best golfer in the world right now. I think he's the most dominant golfer since Tiger, easily. But I do need to see more from him. That's not a knock on Scotty at all. I just need to see him do this for a longer stretch of time in order for me personally to compare Scottie Scheffler to Tiger Woods. You know, can we get Scottie to eight majors? Let's get him even with Watson before we start comparing him to Tiger Woods. Okay? I mean, again, you can do whatever you want. I'm not going to compare him to Tiger until he probably gets to 8-10 majors. But definitely very dominant. I will say this. The one area where I can easily compare Scottie Scheffler to Tiger Woods is his dominance of his peers. Now, look, I don't know what happened when Jack Nicklaus was rising to become largely agreed upon the greatest golfer in the history of the sport, while he was playing. We all know that early on, Jack had to play against Billy Casper. Well, I'm sorry, Arnold Palmer and some of the great players of the 60s, Gary Player. And then in the 70s, he had to play against Weisskopf and Gary Player and Johnny Miller and Lee Trevino. You know, it's just a list of stars that are all Golf Hall of Famers. But I don't know if anyone ever said, while Jack was making his run, boy, his competition, these guys are soft. You know, these guys, they just roll over. Why doesn't anyone stand up to Jack as a golfer? I do know for a fact those words or words of that nature were said constantly during Tiger's run from 97 to about, you know, let's say 2008 before he got injured. And then, of course, he had several great years after that, 13, 15, whatever. But the knock on Tiger's competition had always been, these guys can't stand up to him, therefore they must not be great golfers, which I've always disagreed with. I mean, the biggest victim of Tiger Woods' birth easily was Phil Mickelson. I mean, if you look at Phil Mickelson, you look at Ernie Els, you look at Vijay Singh, David Toms, David Duval, Davis Love III. These were great, great, great golfers who just happened to be playing in an era where Tiger Woods existed. If Tiger was never born, some of these golfers would be considered all-time greats in the history of the game. So I don't think you can kind of diminish the quality of competition just because a singular figure arises and dominates that competition. I think you can probably say the same thing for Scottie Scheffler. It's weird because you do kind of get the same feeling that you got when Tiger was in his heyday of, does anyone plan on pushing this guy? Will anyone, quote unquote, stand up to this guy competitively? Scottie Scheffler. And, you know, to Tiger's credit, he played, I think, more close tournaments, majors and regular tournaments, tour events, than I think Scottie has played, generally speaking. But Tiger also blew out the field much more often, I think, and by a larger margin than Scottie is doing now. Although Scottie, when he wins, he tends to win by 3-4 strokes, right? It's usually not much of a contest. You don't see Scottie in very many tight matches. You certainly don't see him in very many playoffs. So there's that. But if you look at golf before Scottie's rise, let's say before 2021, let's give him 4 years, right? Think about what golf looked like before Scottie Scheffler really started to put it all together. You had people like Justin Thomas, Colin Morikawa, Will Zalatoris, Patrick Cantlay, Xander Schauffele. You had all these golfers basically in a dogfight to see who was going to be number one. And it was a very, very competitive group. I would argue, instead of criticizing the group of golfers that have yet to figure out how to beat Scottie Scheffler, I would just give Scottie Scheffler credit in saying he's that much better than them right now. And, you know, let's not forget, pre-2021, Rory was the guy that they were all gunning for. And if you think about it, if you're Rory McIlroy, boy, oh boy. I mean, you saw up close, firsthand, at Royal Portrush a week ago, if you're Rory McIlroy, that it could be very difficult to win majors moving forward. He is going to have his A plus 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 game if he's going to beat Scottie Scheffler. And so if you're Rory, you know, he has, what, five majors, career Grand Slam? If you're Rory, you have to really, you did this before, you did this in real time, but especially now, if you're Rory, you have to really kind of rue all those majors that slipped through your fingers. He's at five now. He could easily be at eight, nine major wins. I mean, he could be knocking on the door of double-digit wins, literally being considered an all-time great, an all-time immortal. He's clearly an all-time great. He won the career Grand Slam, but he could have been at an even higher level had he been able to cash in on some of the opportunities that laid in front of him when it comes to majors. But now it's going to be a lot harder. It's going to be very difficult to beat Scottie Scheffler when he is in form, and he is in form more often than not every day. He's on tour these days. I don't know if you're a player, if you consider yourself a great player, let's say you're Justin Thomas, right? Two-time major winner, won, 16 times on tour? If you're Justin Thomas, any tournament that's a major that Scottie Scheffler is out of, I used to say the same thing with Tiger, you have to find a way to win that tournament. I mean, if you're Xander Schauffele, which is, again, it was a lost year for Xander. I'm sure he's taking it as hard as anyone else, but it was very much a lost year for Xander. If you're Colin Morikawa, you know, you're like, you're a two-time major winner, I think. I think Colin won two or three. I think he won two. You're a two-time major winner as well. I mean, anytime Scheffler is not in the mix, you have to find a way to win that tournament if you're a quote-unquote great player. You can't let a J.J. Spahn. You can't let a Wyndham Clark. You can't let a Brian Harman win these majors if you're one of these great players. Xander Schauffele, Justin Thomas, Colin Morikawa, Rory McIlroy. You can't let those wins go to other players outside of Scotty. It has to be, if you're going to lose a major, it has to be to Scotty Scheffler. Otherwise, it's a missed opportunity. And I felt the same way when Tiger was not in contention during his 15-year run. You know, if you were Ernie Els, if you were Phil Mickelson, if you were Vijay Singh, if you were any of these guys, you had to find a way to win that major because you don't have that many opportunities where Tiger is not in the mix. And that is going to be the same, I believe, moving forward with Scottie Scheffler. Unless it all goes away. Look, golf is a very fickle game. We said this before. And as quickly as you figure it out, it can leave you. You know, ask Max Homa. Ask Will Zalatoris. Ask Anthony Kim. Anyone remember Anthony Kim from back in the 90s? Golf phenom? What about Matthew Wolf? Golf execution can come and go with no notice. I mean, you don't always get a warning. So that's why we all need, myself included, to see Scotty sustain this over a few more years before we can start comparing him to all-time legendary greats. Tiger Woods, Jack Nicklaus, name your great. Because this might be the beginning of something really, really special. A legendary career. But it also could be the beginning of a run which is not going to be sustained. I'm going to ask you a question, folks. In 2016, if I asked you, how many majors do you think Jordan Spieth will win from 2016 on, moving forward? I'll bet money your answer would have been more than one. And the reality is he only won the one, the 2016 Open Championship. It is really, it can leave you like that. It's amazing. And look, it's not like Jordan's been horrible, but he has never been able to duplicate the stretch that he had from, let's say, 2013, 2014 to 2016. It was an unbelievable run. It was one of the magical runs in the history of golf. His 2015 season was one of the best seasons in the history of golf. But just because you do it once doesn't mean you can sustain it. And that's what we're looking for from Scottie Scheffler. Can he sustain it? Who knows? I'm rooting for him to sustain it. But I have to see it in order to believe it. All that being said, congratulations, Scottie Scheffler. Wonderful job over at Royal Purpress. Congratulations. Okay, so I have to say, there was a list that was put out about a week ago by Bleacher Report, and it's yet another top 100. Top 100 NBA players of all time. And folks, I'm not going to spend a lot of time on this because you know, as listeners and viewers of this show, how I feel about some of these players that are mentioned. But I do have to give you my opinion since this list came out, again, about a week ago. I think it was like 8-9 days ago. And I didn't get to it last week. I'm getting to it right now. So don't blame me for talking about some of the same players that we've talked about in the past. Bleacher Report started this, not me. All right? So their top five, Bleacher Report's top five out of the top 100 of all time are fine. I mean, you can quibble with a player here or there. You can quibble with the order, but I will give you their order. In order from 1 to 5, and then we will move on from there. Bleacher Report classifies Michael Jordan as 1, LeBron 2, Kareem 3, Magic 4, and Bill Russell 5. Again, I think you would be hard pressed to argue with any of those players, with the possible exception of Magic Johnson, who I believe, for the vast majority of my life, was the greatest player in the history of the NBA. But if you're going to quibble with anyone, you might quibble with Magic Johnson. But the other four, you have to leave alone. I mean, you're not going to kick any of those four out of the top four. You can quibble with the order. You can argue about the order. That's fine. But those four, I would say those five, including Magic, I can live with. It's not outrageous. The trouble starts with 6 through 11. And folks, I'm just gonna get into it right now. Look, they list the number six greatest player of all time is Shaquille O'Neal. Folks, I love, L-O-V-E, love Shaquille O'Neal. And I think he's probably underrated historically, but is Shaquille O'Neal the sixth greatest player in the history of the NBA? No, in my opinion. He's just not. And he was a great, great, immortal great player. But he is not sixth all time. On my list, I have Shaq. He's easily in the top 20 of all time. But I have him probably around 12, between 12 and 15, right? There's no shame in that. That's not the worst thing in the world. But Bleacher Report has Shaquille O'Neal as the number sixth player. in the history of the NBA. It's a little high for me. Number seven, they have Tim Duncan. Okay. Tim Duncan, I think, is definitely top 10 on my list. But, you know, I'm not going to quibble at seven. Is Tim Duncan six, seven, eight, nine? Who knows? I just know he's in my top 10, so I can't kill Bleacher Report for putting him at seven in their top 10. Issue number two, listed at number eight on Bleacher Report's top 100 players in NBA history, Larry Bird. Folks, we have talked about this before. A significant portion of you, including my own brother, disagree with me vehemently on my thoughts on Larry Bird. Larry Bird was a great, great, all-time great player, but he does not make my top 10. Larry Bird probably for me is probably around 11, 12, something like that. And again, there is no shame in that at all. There's a lot of great players that have played this game. I just don't think Larry Bird is, I don't think he's top 10. Not in my top 10 anyway. And that has nothing to do with him being a Celtic, by the way. I'm not a Celtic fan, but that has nothing to do with him being a Celtic. The big problem for me is, who do they list as the ninth greatest player in the history of the NBA? And you can forget what I say about Larry Bird being top 10 or not top 10, whatever, right? Here's the real problem. I personally can't put Larry Bird ahead of the number nine position on Bleacher Report's top 100 players of all time in the NBA history, who is Wilt Chamberlain. Folks, we did this a couple weeks ago. I'm not going to do it again. But I will say this. Any list that does not rank Wilt Chamberlain as top five in the history of the NBA, I have trouble taking seriously. All right? I'm not knocking anybody over Bleacher Report. I'm just saying there's no way Wilt Chamberlain is not considered a better player than Larry Bird, number one. Number two, there is no way that Wilt Chamberlain, in any order, one through five, is not considered one of the top five players in the history of the NBA. That is what I have to say about that. Now, the last problem with this list, and again, there are, again, there's 100 players, and you can argue about any of them. That's fine. But my third big problem with this list, especially with the top 11, is that after Wilt Chamberlain is listed at 9, they list number 10, Steph Curry, number 11, Kobe Bryant. Yes, I know what you're saying. It always, always, always comes back to Kobe on this program. Why? I have no idea. I think probably because, in my mind, Kobe is underrated historically, but we can get into that later. Look, we've gone through these numbers. Steph is a transformational player. Steph Curry is obviously the greatest shooter, in my opinion, in the history of the NBA. And you've had some unbelievable shooters in the history of the NBA that span multiple eras. Steph Curry is the best, in my opinion. But that being said, oh my gosh, there is no way and there is no circumstance in which I can rank Steph Curry, as unbelievable as he is, above or ahead of Kobe Bryant. Folks, we've done this before. Kobe, he averaged more points than Steph per game. He has more titles than Steph. He has the same number of scoring titles as Steph. He has, he has more 50-point games than Steph Curry. Yes, Kobe Bryant has 25 50-point games. Steph Curry has 15 50-point games. Come on. I mean, look, you can say what you want to about Kobe Bryant. I could care less. But as long as you tell me he's in the top 10, I'm not going to have an argument with you. I can't do it. I can't have Steph ahead of Kobe. And Steph is a great player. But I can't have him ahead of Kobe. Now, we all know Kobe also, not to mention, was a tremendous defensive player, which is not really a strength of Steph Curry. Not a knock, just a fact. I could go on, but I'm not going to. All right. That's Bleacher Report's, a taste of Bleacher Report's 100 top NBA players of all time. Do yourselves a favor. You should actually go look up this list. It's actually kind of an interesting list, I have to say. There are some players on there that, you know, are surprises. There are some players, I'm not sure many people got left off, but there are some surprises on the list. It's definitely worth looking at. It's kind of a quirky list as far as I'm concerned. A little too quirky for my taste, but that's okay. All right, folks, we are going to talk about episode 2 of Live Aid, when Rock and Roll Took on the World. That's the CNN documentary that's been airing the last couple of Sundays. This past Sunday, that episode focused on the We Are the World recording and the first leg of the Live Aid concert, which took place at Wembley Stadium. Folks, I've really been enjoying this documentary, I have to say. I'm a big documentary fan in general, but this has been well done. It's not Civil War Ken Burns well done, but it's been entertaining, right? Harry Belafonte, obviously, was the driving force behind the We Are the World recording, which Harry kind of put together after looking at the response to the Band-Aid, Do They Know It's Christmas, recording that took place in November of 1984. They show some footage of Geldof, who was invited to speak at the We Are the World recording, which took place, when was it? January 28th, 1985. This was right after the American Music Awards, which Lionel Richie hosted. Geldof delivers this kind of this pregame, pre-recording speech to all the stars assembled, all the artists assembled. And it is tremendous. I mean, he's talking about the reason we're doing this is because people are starving. Use your voices. Think about this while you're singing the lyrics to this song. It is awesome. I wish you could have heard the whole speech, but the little snippet they give you, Geldof comes off great. And again, he comes off as a man on a mission. Now, We Are the World, in my opinion, is a better song than Do They Know It's Christmas. Do They Know It's Christmas is a fine song. It's light, it's joyful. A little on the fluffy side. But We Are the World, really, with all these artists, really turns into this power ballad, which is so well executed. You can't imagine what that song would have been like if Prince had been in the Huey Lewis slot. It would have been really, really interesting to hear where that song went with Prince as a participant. Anyway, so even after both singles were released, they were big hits, they sold a lot, they raised a lot of money, money was still having issues getting to the people in need in Ethiopia, largely because there were these gangs in Ethiopia kind of stopping the aid from getting to the people. They were, you know, robbing aid trucks, or they were intimidating, not letting people pass. I don't know what happened, but apparently aid was having a tough time getting to the people in need. So Geldof comes up with the idea of we need to do more. What is more? Let's do a concert. So Live Aid as a concert, it was announced on June 10th of 1985. The broadcast, the actual performance on the concert, occurred on July 13th, 1985. Folks, this was a global undertaking on two continents, Wembley Stadium in London, JFK Stadium in Philadelphia, which no longer exists, but it's in the same sports complex as the current Wells Fargo, the Link, Citizens Bank, where all the teams play. It's in South Philadelphia. But to get this done in essentially 4.5 weeks was a monumental task. And they go into, you know, some of the challenges that they faced in getting it done. Not to mention technical challenges, but, you know, getting artists to commit. Phil Collins was one of the artists who decided to play the Wembley leg of the stadium and then take the Concorde over to the U.S. to make sure that he also played the Philadelphia leg of the concert. So that was interesting. It turns out David Bowie was one of the true heroes of Live Aid. Why do I say that? Because, look, while there were some unbelievable performances during Live Aid, Status Quo, Queen, U2, any number of great performances, people were kind of just watching on TV and in the stadium having a great time, but the phones weren't ringing. People weren't actually calling in, making donations during the vast majority of the Wembley stadium leg of the Live Aid presentation. And David Bowie, he basically agrees to do the show, but he says, I'm not singing my old stuff. I'm going to sing my new single. My new single is a song called Heroes. I'm going to sing that. And I'm also going to play a video after I sing my song. So Bowie does Heroes. Good song. Everyone knows that. We can be heroes. We know that song. And then he plays this video of starving Ethiopian children after the song. Supposedly, I vaguely remember this, watching it, actually. You could have heard a pin drop in Wembley Stadium, 65,000 people there. And right after that, the phones start lighting up. People giving money, people giving donations, Live Aid essentially starts to become a success after David Bowie shows the video. So kudos to him. He does a great job. It's been a very good series. I can't wait to watch the third installment, which is obviously going to be taking place dealing with the U.S. portion of the Live Aid concert, where there were some iconic moments. So there is that. Folks, I do have to say this briefly. I can't tell you how happy I am to have football back. And I'm going to give a little bit of a nod to football being back by asking a question. Who needs a Super Bowl more in 2025? Lamar Jackson or Josh Allen? Folks, I got to tell you, they both could use a Super Bowl. I mean, I can't tell you. I mean, who knows which one is more jealous of Jalen Hurts? Because, I mean, either player would give substantial sums of money to have beaten Patrick Mahomes to get to the Super Bowl, not to mention beating Patrick Mahomes in the Super Bowl. That being said, I'm gonna read you some numbers and I'm gonna give you my answer. But I want to know who you think needs a Super Bowl for their legacy more, Lamar Jackson or Josh Allen? Here are some numbers. Lamar obviously is a two-time MVP. He's a three-time first-team All-Pro quarterback. His career record is 70-24. He has a 65% completion rating with 20,000 yards passing, 166 touchdowns to 49 interceptions. Lamar has also rushed for over 6,000 yards. He has 33 rushing TDs, but strangely, 63 fumbles. Josh Allen, obviously, is the reigning MVP. He's won the one MVP. And he's a two-time second-team NFL All-Pro quarterback. His record is 76-34. He has a 63% completion rating and has thrown for almost 26,500 yards with 195 passing touchdowns and 84 interceptions. Now, Josh Allen has also rushed for over 4,100 yards, 65 TDs, and 64 fumbles. Now, if you look at them in the regular season, obviously, I shouldn't say obviously. I mean, you might not know this unless you saw them play, but Lamar has been the better quarterback in the regular season. I don't think it's even close. He's more dynamic, and that's saying something because Josh Allen is one of the most dynamic quarterbacks in the history of modern football. But Lamar has been a better regular season player. I don't think there's much anyone can argue against that. Here are the playoff numbers. Lamar's playoff career record is 3-5. He has a 60.6 completion rating with over 1,700 passing yards, 10 touchdowns, and 7 interceptions in 8 career playoff games. His rushing numbers, Lamar, is 641 rushing yards, 3 TDs, and 7 fumbles in the playoffs. Remember, this is 8 career playoff games. Josh Allen's playoff record. He has a career record of 7-6 in the playoffs with a 66% completion. 3,359 passing yards with 25 TDs and 4 interceptions in 13 career games. Folks, these are his passing numbers in the playoffs. In 13 games, this took place over 6 postseasons. Josh has rushed for 668 yards, 7 touchdowns, and 12 fumbles. Folks, just as it's obvious to me that Lamar has been the better regular season quarterback, it is plainly obvious that Josh Allen has been the better postseason quarterback. And if you're talking about legacy, who needs it more? Who really needs to win a Super Bowl? I won't even say win a Super Bowl. Who needs to get to a Super Bowl more? Lamar Jackson or Josh Allen to validate their career? Folks, I think the answer has to be Lamar Jackson. I mean, I just read you the numbers. Josh Allen, for better or worse, has been a very good postseason player. Lamar has not. And if it all ended today and they both had to go home and retire, Josh Allen would be really, really, really mad that he never found his way to a Super Bowl. But I think Lamar Jackson, his legacy would be incomplete without getting to a Super Bowl. I'm not saying that Josh doesn't need a Super Bowl. I'm not saying that Josh wouldn't like to be validated in that way. But let's be fair. When Baltimore has lost, Lamar Jackson in the postseason has been a contributing factor. When Buffalo has lost in the postseason, Josh Allen, generally speaking, has not been the issue. He's played well. He's just gotten beat. So, I wanted to run that past you guys. Let me know what you think. Congratulations. Camp is back. Football is back. I can't wait. We're going to be talking about it a lot. Go Birds. Now, really, this is the point of the program where I get to ask you my other favorite question. What are you drinking tonight? Well, I can tell you what I'm drinking. And that is Mossburn Single Malt Scotch Whiskey. Folks, I'm going to tell you a little bit about this product, and then I'm going to tell you what I think of this product. Now, here's some stats. It is produced by Mossburn Distillers and Blenders. It's distilled by the Ben Rennes Distillery. I'm not sure if I pronounced that correctly, but I gave it a shot. It is aged 10 years. It is non-chill filtered. There is no color added. It is 57.1 ABV, which makes it 114 proof. And this particular bottle costed me $84. What do I think of it, folks? It's a little light. Light is not bad, but it's light. It's inoffensive in some ways. It's not heavily peated, which is not the worst thing in the world. But I will say this. It doesn't have a ton of character. I mean, it's fine as a drink. I don't think I would include this as part of my regular bar rotation. This particular bottle is the number 21. I don't know if you guys can see that, but apparently there are different blends. So Mossburn Single Malt Scotch Whiskey. It's solid. It's okay. But for $84, I think I'll pass on the next bottle. Anyway, that is our show for tonight, folks. Thank you for watching. Thank you so much for listening. My name is Cyrus Farmer. You have been watching and listening to the Stop the Tea program. We will be back at you next week with another scintillating episode. But for now, as always, we will see you on the first tee.